Hallelujah. A political cartoonist in the local paper was commenting on the high price of gasoline. He drew a picture of a filling station gasoline pump, and in place of the regular price of gasoline was assigned reading an arm. The price of ethanol blend, in place of the price there, it says a leg. And the price of premium were the words, your firstborn. With gas almost $2 a gallon here and more than $2 a gallon nationwide, it certainly feels sometimes that it costs us an arm and a leg and sometimes even our firstborn to fill up. Have you ever given much thought to the concept of firstborn, first fruits? This is the day we think about those things. The firstborn or first fruit is considered the choicest in the scriptures, whether it's animal, crop, or human. These are considered sanctified or set apart to Yahweh. These are special. First fruits, like firstborn, are the important key, really, to understanding salvation itself. The first resurrection of the saints is all about first fruits, first born into the kingdom. Now, there are many names for this feast. There's Pentecost, there's Feast of Weeks, there's Shavuot. But I think the one that really describes it best is the Feast of First Fruits. This is a feast about first fruits of the harvest. Unlike secular observances that are a mishmash of many different unholy themes all dressed in religious garb, Yahweh's feast days are based on the agricultural harvests, something that we've forgotten in our culture today. Something that we don't seem to connect with anymore is the harvest times. But Yahweh's feast days go back to that, and they focus on that. The connection between the physical harvest and the harvest of the saints at Yahshua's return is really clear. These feasts show Yahweh's salvation plan, and they're prophetic as well. Each feast we keep is another advance, another window into our understanding. The agricultural process, if you think about it, the planting of the seed, hoping it'll grow. You know, Yahshua talked a lot about a parable about planting seed on different ground. We have rock, we have soil that's ready, we have all these weeds that grow up and quench it. But when you think about it, what Yahweh is doing with his people is the same type of deal with seed. It grows, it takes root. It then produces fruit. And then it dies. And the fruit take over as seed. And it grows and it grows. Yahshua and Paul talked about a lot about this, about producing fruit in one's life as you grow, the maturing of the believer. And from the maturing in wisdom and knowledge to the replanting of the truth, and finally the harvest. All of this parallels the agricultural ties. And the harvest motif plays a central theme, a central role. Even Yahshua taught this symbolism. Let's turn to John chapter 20, verse 1. He became the wave sheaf of the earlier barley harvest that took place during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. He became the first of the first fruits, you might say. He was the one who preceded all. In John 20, verse 17, Mary wanted to touch him. And he said, "Don't do it. I have not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren, and say unto them, I ascend unto my Father and your Father, and to my Elohim and your Elohim." When was this? This was during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And he ascended as the wave sheaf during the Sabbath of that feast. In doing so, he presented himself as the untainted first fruits to Yahweh. Exodus 23:19. First fruits, very important concept when we look at Yahweh's word and his people and what they're all about here on this earth It says, the first of the first fruits, Exodus 23:19, the first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of Yahweh your Elohim. The first of the first fruits. That's what Yahshua was, the first of the first fruits. Verse 6 of chapter 34 of Exodus, we find another teaching here. And Yahweh passed by before him and proclaimed, Yahweh, Yahweh, Elohim, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth. Merciful and gracious. Keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin and iniquity, and that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, the children's children unto the third and fourth generation. Yahweh is merciful to his first fruits. Yahweh has a special place in his heart for the first fruits. Over in Ezekiel chapter 44. Ezekiel 44 and verse 30. And the first of all the first fruits of all things, and every oblation of all, of every sort of your oblations, shall be the priest. You shall also give unto the priest the first of your dough, that he may cause the blessing to rest in your house. First of the first fruits were given up to the priest. The priest, of course, would give them to Yahweh. Ezekiel 44:30. Based on that offering of Yahshua's wave sheaf, as the wave sheaf, we count 7 weeks, 49 days, and the next day, yesterday was the 49th day. The next day would be the 50th. And that's where the Greek word Pentecost comes from, means 50th. But it's the Feast of First Fruits. 49 plus 1. Yahshua was presented on the first day of the wave sheaf to Yahweh, and on the 50th day, the first fruit saints joined that presentation with themselves coming before Yahweh in the first resurrection. Each of those 7 weeks is a preparation, is a time for that seed to grow. And each of those weeks is important in the development of the believer. This is the last feast until the fall. And it's a time when we reflect on who we are as Yahweh's first fruits. It's the same in the series of the 7 sabbatical years that are count toward the Jubilee. The same counting takes place in both. And lessons taught, leading to the Jubilee, which of course represents the kingdom. When you understand this parallel of complete 7 weeks, then any other count is clearly wrong. And there are people who are counting it wrongly. Some count from the first high day, the 15th, like the Jews, and always end up with Sivan 6. There's no point in counting if you're always going to end up on the same day, which they keep as the first fruits feast. Turn to Leviticus 23. I want to look at this while we're here. Leviticus 23 and verse 15, this, of course, is the command. And he says, you shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. This refers to verse 11. You shall wave the sheaf before Yahweh to be accepted for you on the morrow after the Sabbath. The priest shall wave it. That word there is Shabbat, means weekly Sabbath. So that's when the wave sheaf was waved. Then you count 7 complete weeks. There's the key, that word complete. It has to be complete weeks. 7, 7, 7, 7, all the way to 49 and then 50. If we count from the high Sabbath during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which some do, like the Jews do, and not the weekly Sabbath, we introduce several problems. What do we do about the other high Sabbath? Most people just ignore that. Do we count it as one of the 7 Sabbaths? What about the weekly Sabbath during the feast? They ignore that too. Those who employ the first high day simply gloss over that one and then launch into the weekly Sabbaths. So what they're doing is mixing high Sabbath and weekly Sabbath. And they end up with not complete weeks, normally. Normally, you're going to end up with the first part of 1 week and then 7777. It's not going to comply with Scripture. Where is the command for that? If we do that, we have another problem. Leviticus 23:15 says, "You shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, seven Sabbaths shall be complete." Two important words. Sabbaths, complete. Complete is temim in the Hebrew, and it means in the sense of the entire whole thing. Intact, not cut into pieces, you see. You can't take parts of weeks. You have complete weeks. Seven Sabbaths shall be complete, and that means complete weeks. Seven periods of 7 days in the 7 day week. Very clear. The NIV says, count off 7 full weeks. The New American Bible says, you shall count 7 full weeks. Note that the word is weeks, not sevens. So that implies Sabbath, doesn't it? Our week begins on the first day of the week and ends on the Sabbath. So we're talking about 7 Sabbaths, not high days and parts of weeks. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 16. We read Deuteronomy here in the short offering message, Deuteronomy 16. So we have an indication of when we start this count. 16 and verse 9 says, 7 weeks shall you number unto you. Begin to number the 7 weeks. And we're talking about complete weeks again. From such time as you begin to put the sickle to the corn. You start cutting the wave sheaf. That is during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That's Sabbath there. The Feast of First Fruits is a picture of Yahweh's redeemed body of believers, represented by the first fruits of the wheat harvest. We're now into the wheat harvest. And before they could begin the wheat harvest, they had to wave 2 loaves before Yahweh. Two loaves of wheat bread before Yahweh, which we have up here, in case you were wondering what those were up there for. They did that. The priest did that before Yahweh, presented to him symbolically. Now, there's different ideas of what those loaves represented. Compared to wheat, barley is a much lesser grown crop. It originated in the Middle East, by the way, interesting enough. But barley matures earlier, which we know in the Passover time is when the barley was in the green ear stage. And now we come to the wheat harvest, which is more general and more widely grown around the world. It represents more of a larger group of believers. Yahshua being the first fruits of the barley, which is small. The first fruits of the wheat is a lot bigger. Bigger harvest, more people. Representing a wider range of Yahweh's elect. In 1 Corinthians 15, verse 20, Yahshua is called the first fruits of many. 1 Corinthians 15, 20 and 23. And afterward, it says, they that are Messiahs at his coming. So they're going to be other first fruits, but he's the first. In James 1:18, it says, we are a kind of first fruits of his creatures. So that's what his people are. The teaching of the firstborn, the first fruits, is central in the scriptures. In Numbers chapter 3, Yahweh says that the firstborn belong to him. We talked about the importance of the firstborn, the first fruits. It says, he talks about the generations of Aaron and so forth. You shall appoint Aaron and his sons. They shall wait on the priest's office and so forth. And he goes through this and establishes the priesthood. But it says here in verse 45, take the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the children of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites instead of their cattle, and the Levites shall be mine. So the Levites are almost like a first of the first fruits there. For those who are to be redeemed of the 213,000 of the firstborn of the children of Israel, which are more than the Levites, you shall take 5 shekels apiece by the pole. After the shekel and sanctuary shall you take them. The shekel is 20 gerahs. and you shall give the money wherewith the odd number of them is to be redeemed unto Aaron and his sons. And Moses took the redemption money of them that were over them and above them that were redeemed by the Levites. Of the firstborn of the children of Israel took he the money, 1,365 shekels after the shekel of the sanctuary. And Moses gave the money of them that were redeemed unto Aaron and to his sons according to the word of Yahweh, as Yahweh commanded. So he divided up the Levites and the firstborn that were given in Yahweh's service. The firstborn had privileges denied others. You couldn't disinherit the firstborn. That's in Deuteronomy chapter 21. Deuteronomy 21, where someone who was born from, if a man happened to have two wives. Deuteronomy 21, verse 15, if a man have two wives, one beloved, another hated, and they have been born children, both the beloved and the hated, and if the firstborn son be hers that was hated, then it shall be, when he makes his sons to inherit that which he has, that he may not make the son of the first of the beloved firstborn before the son of the hated, which is indeed the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has. For he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. The right of the firstborn was double the inheritance. So, no matter what circumstance came about, this was the firstborn, and this law was inviolate. You could not ignore it. The firstborn got twice the inheritance. Remember when Elisha prayed for a double portion of Eliah's spirit? He wished to be considered the firstborn successor to the dying prophet. Israel's firstborn was Yahweh's firstborn and had privileges denied other people. You find that in Psalm 89, verse 27. The firstborn and the firstfruits are parallel ideas. And this is the feast that commemorates the firstfruits and zeroes in on their role in Yahweh's design. Let's look back at Leviticus 23 again. I want to continue on to verse 16. Because there's important lessons to be learned here in this teaching. Even unto the morrow after the seventh Sabbath, you shall number 50 days, and you shall offer a new meat offering unto Yahweh. You shall bring out of your habitations 2 wave loaves of 2/10 deals. They shall be of fine flour. They shall be baked with leaven. They are the first fruits unto Yahweh. And you shall offer with the bread 7. Now, why did these loaves, why were they baked with leaven? Well, if Yahshua was the first of the first fruits, his was unleavened, right? During the Passover and Feast of Unleavened Bread. However, if these wave loaves represent Yahweh's people after Yahshua, they have leaven. They have sin that has been they've had to overcome. So that makes very much sense if we look at the symbolism in these two ideas. He says, you shall offer, verse 18, with the bread 7 lambs without blemish of the first year, and 1 young bullock and 2 rams. They shall be for a burnt offering unto Yahweh with their meat offering and their drink offerings, even an offering made by fire of sweet savor unto Yahweh. And he says, you shall sacrifice 1 kid of the goats for a sin offering, 2 lambs of the first year for a sacrifice of peace offerings. The priest shall wave them with the bread of the first fruits for a wave offering before Yahweh. They claim it's like this, you know, back and forth. It's not like this, but like this, showing that he covers all the people in and around the temple there, or the tabernacle. And with the 2 lambs, they shall be holy to Yahweh for the priest, and you shall proclaim on the selfsame day that it may be a holy convocation unto you. You shall do no servile work therein. It shall be a statute forever, olam, without end, in all your dwellings throughout your generations. And when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not make clean riddance of the corners of the field when you reap, neither shall you gather any gleanings of your harvest. You shall leave them unto the poor and to the stranger. I am Yahweh, your Elohim. So this is the law that contains the circumstances in which we're here today. This is what we're doing as a statute forever, keeping the Feast of First Fruits. The wave offerings are part of the peace offerings, which were offerings indicating a right relationship with Yahweh. They express gratitude, obligation, good fellowship. Why the two leavened loaves, you may ask? Why two? Maybe they represent the two divisions of Israel coming back together, like in Ezekiel 37. Or perhaps they commemorate Israel and the Gentiles coming together as part of the same covenant. Whatever they are, they're two, and this feast focuses on them as the first fruits. You must have the Spirit, no matter whether you're of Israel, Gentile, whatever. You must have the Spirit to be changed and resurrected. And that's another reason that the Spirit was given generally to all during the Feast of Pentecost, Feast of First Fruits in Acts 2. Let's turn to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8 and verse 9. Is a lesson here for us in the Spirit. It says, "But you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if so be that the Spirit of Elohim dwells in you. If any man have not the Spirit of Messiah, he is none of his." If he has not the Spirit of Messiah, he is none of his. "And if Messiah be in you, the body is dead because of sin, but the Spirit is life because of righteousness." The Spirit is essential in identifying the first fruits to Yahweh. And so it's appropriate that it be given at the Feast of First Fruits. You know, the Bible is such an amazing book, a continuum from Genesis through Revelation. What we see operating in the New Testament had its roots back in the Old. People talk about Pentecost. They talk about Pentecostal. They name churches after the term Pentecostal and have no clue that this is one of Yahweh's feast days that should be kept along with the other six. But this is what has happened, and Yahweh's word has been divided. Not rightly divided, but divided. The first part taken and thrown off. The second half, or second third, or last third, I should say, has been twisted and torn away from its roots. What we see operating in the New Testament had its roots in the Old. And what we see introduced in the Old Testament continues in the New. However, modified to, you know, harmonize with a different priesthood. I want to look at some misnomers surrounding the Old and New Testaments and the Feast of First Fruits. Common belief is that love, grace, and faith are only New Testament concepts. Unknown in the Old. The Old is a whole different mindset in people's understanding. They think it's a bunch of bloody acts, a bunch of vengeance from Yahweh, and a bunch of people dying all the time, and a bunch of onerous laws that Yahweh gave that nobody can keep anyway. And so we just go with love, grace, and faith in the New Testament. And all of these, of course, are alive and well in the Old, and you can prove that in many, many scriptures. You find that obedience is better than sacrifice in the Old Testament as well as the New. Then why, if that is the case, are the laws commanded? The laws of sacrifice. Well, it's all part of what Yahweh commanded. That Israel had to learn the tough lessons because they wouldn't learn them the easy way. You know, it's either the easy way or the hard way, and they decided it was the hard way for them. So they had to sacrifice, they had to kill, they had to understand that a sin brings on the death of something. And if not themselves, it had to be covered by blood of the animal if they were to be right with Yahweh. And you find that obedience here is very much in tune with what we find in the New Testament. You find law placed in the heart in the Old Testament as well as the New. You find righteousness, not of ourselves, but of Yahweh in the Old Testament as well as the New. Looking from the other direction, we find 1,050 commands and laws in the New Testament, according to Dake's reference Bible. Even the Spirit was active in the Old Testament. People think, well, the Spirit came at Pentecost, you know, and this is the the start of the New Testament assembly. But all you have to do is look back at Joseph, Genesis 41. Joseph, even Pharaoh recognized that Joseph had the Spirit. Remember the guy named Bezalel who helped manufacture the tabernacle with his craftsmanship? Yahweh gave him an extra portion of Spirit to help him do that. Numbers 11 talks about Moses having the Spirit. 70 elders had the Spirit in the same chapter. Balaam, Numbers 24, had the Spirit. Othniel, Judges 3, verse 10, to deliver Israel. He was given the Spirit. Samson had the Spirit. How could he carry the gates of the city up a mountain, you know, without the power and the strength of Yahweh's Spirit? Judges 14. Azariah, 2 Chronicles 15, 1. David, Psalm 51, he talks about, take not your Spirit from me. And the prophets, 2 Peter 1, 21, they all had the Spirit. This is not something that's new, you see. We see this Feast of First Fruits operating in the Old Testament because it's a feast that's calling the first fruits forward, and they were given the Spirit as well. Many never think that Acts 2 was not the inauguration of Pentecost, nor the first giving of the Spirit, nor the beginning of the New Testament, quote, church. Pentecost was in effect for Israel of old. Israel was still counting 7 weeks long before, thousands of years before Acts 2. Well, let's turn to Acts 2, as long as we're talking about it. Acts 2 and verse 1. This is the New Testament, New Covenant account of this same feast. It has been in operation for many, many, many centuries. Acts 2 and verse 1. And when the day of Pentecost, first fruits, was fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. Why? Keep the feast, as we are here, all in one place. And suddenly there came a sound from heaven, as it were a rushing mighty wind. Not only is this 50 days from the wave sheaf of the Old Testament law, but 50 days since Yahshua presented himself as the wave sheaf to the Father. 9 days have passed since his ascension. Now in his absence, he sends a comforter, which he called the power of Yahweh's Spirit. We know this is not the beginning of the New Testament assembly. How do we know that? Acts 7:38 tells us, for one thing. Acts 7:38 says, this is he that was in the assembly in the wilderness. The assembly in the wilderness. Which assembly was in the wilderness? Well, back there with Moses. He calls it an assembly of people back there. And with the angel which spoke to him in the Mount Sinai and with our fathers. And if you want to go to the rest of the verse, it says, who received the lively oracles. Oracles, utterances. What Yahweh commanded at Sinai. What? To give to us. We're not, brethren, in Zechariah. We're not in Ezekiel. We're not in Exodus. We're in Acts chapter 7. He's giving the oracles to us, the commandments. We're busily taking them, you know, out of our culture. And because of that, we're being subject to vengeance of Yahweh through wars, through enemies that are wanting to attack us. Why? Cause and effect. We're removing Yahweh. We're facing the consequences in this culture of ours. But anyway, he says to give the commandments to us. Oracles. Most people believe Acts 2 was the beginning of the assembly. Notice what Yahshua himself said in Matthew 18, verse 1. Is it the beginning of the assembly? According to Yahshua. Verse 15, I'm sorry. Acts 18:15. Moreover, if your brother shall trespass against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he shall hear, you gained your brother. But if he will not hear, then take take with you one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses every word shall be established. This is the Matthew 18, got a problem with your brother passage. How do you handle it? Most people go right to the end. They don't worry about going to their brother. They don't worry about trying to work it out with bringing a witness to him. They jump to, verse 17. And if he shall neglect to hear them, tell it unto the assembly. They jump right to that and go around telling everybody about the problem they're having with a brother. Notice what we just read. The assembly. This is before Acts. Yahshua is still here teaching his disciples, you know, up and down the Sea of Galilee and all that. Long before Acts 2, he's talking about an assembly. So we know that the assembly didn't start. That's just, you know, two simple examples. It didn't start in Acts 2. But many people believe because the Spirit was given generally then, that started the New Testament church, which certainly is not a scriptural idea. The Feast of First Fruits, or Pentecost, if you would, initiates the building of the assembly in earnest. This is when the assembly, you know, shifted into overdrive. And when Peter gave his famous message, 3,000 were immersed. Certainly it was the beginning of the assembly in earnest, but the assembly was still established before this. We're grafted into the body of believers, which existed in the times of ancient Israel. Israel was, in fact, the beginning of the assembly. You might even say that Abraham and his offspring were the early assembly because they were the ones called out. They were first fruits. And so was Noah. 1 Corinthians 10 talks about that, talks about the assembly in the wilderness. Shaul mentions it. You're ignorant how all our fathers were under the cloud, passed through the sea, baptized unto Moses, the cloud and the sea, ate of the same spiritual meat, drank the same spiritual drink. Interesting that they drank of that rock, spiritually speaking, talking about Yahweh's Spirit back there in the wilderness, back there at Sinai. The rock that followed that rock was Messiah. But with many of them, Elohim was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. These things were our examples, to the extent we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Verse 11, now all these things happened unto them for examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. That is us. It's not just them back there in the year 25. We're talking about all these things that happen to those in the end times, right? To whom the ends of the world are come. Okay, let's go back to Acts 2 again. Because to understand this feast, we have to understand the examples in all of the Bible of this feast. Acts 2, verse 2, what happened? We're sitting here, and all of a sudden we hear a strange noise. I mean, not just a noise. This is like something we've never heard. Sound from heaven as a rushing, mighty wind, and it filled all the house where they were sitting. Strange wind. And there appeared unto them cloven tongues like as of fire, and it sat upon each of them. A lot of people see the depiction, the painting of fire on everybody's head. Well, it's cloven tongues like as of fire. Trying to describe it in Acts, we have an analogy. It doesn't say it was fire, but it was like a fire. It was energy. You know, it was powerful energy going on at this point. Distributing among themselves. Distributing themselves among the various apostles, right? Resembling fire. Notice, it sat upon each of them. The Spirit, doesn't say he, it says it sat upon each of them. This fire-like stuff, whatever it was. And they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other tongues. The word here is heteros. Heteros. We see that prefix in other words we know. Heterosexual, for one, meaning two different kinds of the same species. It means different from their native language, but another type of language in the same category or the same class of languages. So it's not an angelic thing. It's not gibberish. Just another type of glossa. Every time I have heard tongues spoken, I've heard gibberish. I've never heard a language spoken. But that's what this was. It was languages. An elder one time recorded a service where some of this was being spoken, and he took it to the university and took it to the Department of Languages and played it to different professors, each one representing, I don't know how many different languages, you know, around the world, and asked them, what language is this? None of them could identify it. In fact, one of them says, it's not a language. It can't be, because it doesn't even have the same rules of language. It's just babbling is all it was. Well, here we have languages. Notice, each one heard in his own language, verse 6. And then it goes on to list 15 different nations represented there. And it says, verse 11, Cretes and Arabians, we do hear them speak in our tongues the wonderful works of Elohim. Wonder what all these people were doing there. What are they? Are they keeping the feast? I wonder. Must have come together to keep the feast as Yahshua commanded back in chapter 1. You know, tarry, and I'll send the Spirit. We do hear them, but notice this, speak in our language, our glossa, the wonderful works of Elohim. And they were all amazed and were in doubt, saying one to another, what does this mean? Were they in doubt because they heard a language and said, how could all these people be speaking different languages? No, they were in doubt because they were amazed, not understanding the message. The message. Each one heard in his own language, but he was confused about the message. What these guys were saying. This doesn't make any sense. You're talking about a spirit. You're talking about Yahshua. You're talking about all these things. How could it be? How could this man have risen and, you know, died and risen and lives? I don't understand it. This is what their problem was. Others mocking says, well, these men are full of new wine. They're speaking something that doesn't make any sense. Not in how they spoke it, because they heard it in their own language. That wasn't the problem. It was what they were hearing. But Peter, who got a little bit perturbed at this point, and said, you know, it's time, you know, sometimes you've got to stand up. I'm just, you know, frustrated with all this. He's standing up with the 11, lifted up his voice, and said unto them, you men of Judea, and all you that dwell at Jerusalem, be this known unto you, and hearken to my words. For these are not drunken, as you suppose, seeing it's but the third hour of the day. It's 9 in the morning. People don't go around getting drunk at 9 in the morning unless you're a wino or something. But this is that which was spoken by the prophet Yael. And it shall come to pass in the last days, says Elohim, I will pour out of my spirit upon all flesh. And your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your young men shall see visions. Your old men shall dream dreams. And on my servants and on my handmaids I'll pour out in those days of my spirit, and they shall prophesy. And I will show wonders in heaven above and signs in the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. We're talking about Revelation here, aren't we? The sun shall be turned into darkness, the moon into blood before the great and notable day of Yahweh come. It shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of Yahweh shall be saved. Not everyone. Some people say everyone's going to be saved. No. It says those who call on his name will be saved. So this is what was going on, Pentecost, Acts chapter 2, Feast of First Fruits, I should say, really, because we're tying it in with what it really was, an Old Testament feast that Yahweh gave forever. It's really perplexing to me just how thick-headed these people were. I mean, how many times did Yahshua have to say it, you know, about what he was here for and what would happen after his message, his goal was delivered and his life was called by Yahweh, you know. But he still didn't understand. Mary thought he was the gardener. The 11 didn't believe until he showed his hands in his side to them. Doubting Thomas, I'd actually stick his hand in his side before he'd believe it, touch him. But it was the message in Acts 2 that they found hard to believe. So they thought they were drunk. Yahweh's interference in the events and the affairs of this world are never without his first fruits people involved. That's the message we see all the way through prophecy in the New Testament, even in the Old. They're always central to everything he does. Scripture reveals Yahweh's actions in the Old Testament as they relate to or affect his people. And the same thing in the New Testament. The entire history of his word centers on the seed of Abraham and what happens to them and those that are brought into that same promise. That is the glue that holds the entire Bible together, Yahweh's people, the first fruits. Scripture doesn't talk about Europe, doesn't talk about Asia, doesn't talk about Africa. It talks about the Middle East. It talks about those people chosen of Yahweh. This Mideast focus is true even today, even down to our time. The world's biggest problem area, the world's attention on its news every day is the Middle East, isn't it? Day after day after day. It's not Russia, the European Union. If it weren't for the elect, the first fruits, Yahweh says, there shall no flesh be saved. He'd allow man to destroy himself. And except those days shall be shortened. Matthew 24:22. Only for the sake of Yahweh's people will this earth survive. Kind of humbling, isn't it? Isn't it really? Think about it. If it weren't for his people, the whole thing would go. Just blow up. Gone. Burned up. Probably through multiple nuclear catastrophes, there'd be nothing left. I find that very humbling. Yahweh's preferred choice of punishment on rebellious people is attack by their enemies, by other nations. It's significant, I think, that as we're throwing out Yahweh, throwing out the Ten Commandments, while we're embracing sodomy in this nation, that we're simultaneously being bombarded by threats and by actual attacks from terrorists from the Middle East. Same thing Israel had to face. Enemies in their land. Enemies from around them, from the Middle East. Some believe we're already in the tribulation. I don't think we've seen anything yet. What's going on, what's going to happen ultimately will make 9/11 look like child's play. It says this earth is going to shake to its foundations. It's going to literally shake. Millions will die. One estimate is that only like 20 million people will remain out of, 6 billion? After all the catastrophes, after all the things that are going to happen. We're in the time of birth pangs. Matthew 24, verse 4. Yahshua's Olivet prophecy was all about our day. 24 and verse 4. Yahshua was the greatest prophet, wasn't he? You talk about prophets, he explained it very well. In verse 3, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Yahshua answered and said to them, "Take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, 'I am Messiah,' and they shall deceive many. And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end isn't yet. Nations shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, ethnos, that's race, racial wars, and then kingdom against kingdom as well. And there shall be famines and pestilences, that is disease, and earthquakes in different places. After wars, you always have famine, you always have disease, because you don't have sanitary conditions anymore. All of these are the beginning of sorrows. And then notice what he talks about. They shall deliver you up. Who? First fruits. See, the first fruits always figure into prophecy, always figure into what's happening in the end days. And you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. Who is it that those that have turned from Yahweh in our day hate the worst? They hate Bible believers, don't they? Because they show the sin. They show them up against the sin and they hate it. And they attack those. They don't attack anybody else. They're not attacking Hindus. They're not attacking Muslims. They're attacking Bible believers. You shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended. There's going to be people who are going to be, one way or another, offended by the truth's sake. And shall betray one another and shall hate one another. And you'll have many false prophets arising and shall deceive many as well. You have people coming up and saying they're Messiah, you know. And there's going to be many to be deceived by it. And because of iniquity, because of sin shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. That first fruit that hangs in there till the end will be saved. He won't give up. He knows the truth in his heart no matter what happens. He'll hang in there. This is the good news of the kingdom that shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Who's going to be teaching that good news to all the world? The first fruits, those that are chosen, that understand the truth. And when you shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads shall let him understand, and let them which in Judea flee to the mountains, let them which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house, neither let him which is in the field return back to his clothes. Because that's where the focus then is going to be, that end time war there in Judea. I don't think we're yet being persecuted, at least not as a body, as it will happen. And that's one very important sign that the end is near. And ultimately, we'll need Yahweh's protection. We'll need Yahweh's Spirit, that Spirit that came, the Feast of First Fruits. There have been some really terrible times in history. We've seen, you know, we read about it, we study of the terrible things that have happened down through this existence of man on this earth. There's been world wars, plagues of the Middle Ages, you know, that decimated many, many people. Worse than even that, there have been atrocities that have taken place. And Yahshua said, no, it's going to be even worse than that. Jeremiah chapter 30 and verse 7. Jeremiah chapter 30. The prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah, I think, speaks to us more than any prophet. It speaks to who we are today. And he says here, alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble. But he shall be saved out of it. So there's going to be protection. And it's all not gloom and doom. We know, and Revelation talks about the wilderness and the great wings of an eagle. For it shall come to pass in that day, says Yahweh of hosts, that I will break his yoke from off thy neck and will burst thy bonds, and strangers shall no more serve themselves of him. But they shall serve Yahweh their Elohim and David their king, whom I'll raise up. So there's going to be a time when Yahweh's going to restore his kingdom here on this earth. David's going to be the king under Yahshua. All of them, of course, under Yahweh when he eventually comes and sets up his kingdom, New Jerusalem. The Civil War was bloody. It was really bad. We've made trips back to places like Gettysburg, and you wouldn't believe what happened there and how they fought. Just slaughtered each other, and it was really bad. World War I was bad. Mustard gas and all these things. People were being killed by the thousands, and it was bad. World War II was even worse. Holocaust. Atomic bombs being dropped. But none of this can compare to what's coming. Luke 21 is a bit more specific as to the consequence, the sequence, I should say, of end time prophecy. Luke 21 and verse 7. And Yahshua again picks up his the same thing we saw in Matthew 24. They asked him, Master, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign when these things shall come to pass? He said, take heed, you not be deceived, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Messiah, and deceive many. Go ye not therefore after them. But when you shall hear of wars and commotions, be not terrified, for these things must first come to pass, but the end is not by and by. Then he said unto them, nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and great earthquakes shall be in different places, and famines and pestilences, and fearful sights and great signs shall there be from heaven. But before all these things, they shall lay their hands on you, persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and into the prisons, being brought before kings and rulers. Why? For my name's sake, the first fruits, following Yahweh in his name, calling on his name. It shall turn to you for a testimony. Why is it? You know, we for years we've read in the Bible saying that when Yahshua comes, will there be faith, the faith on the earth? I think, well, how can that be? You know, there's a lot of millions of Bible believers. And yet we're seeing now people are abandoning the Bible, and especially the truth. We just don't see those who would willingly take hold of the truth in numbers as we used to, because people are leaving Yahweh's word. Yahweh's commanded his people to keep his feasts. The Feast of First Fruits is a significant feast telling about the first fruits, their lot, how they became as they are through the power of Yahweh's Spirit. He's commanded his people to keep them. Traditional worship has never kept them. They run the other way. He discussed the commands of Yahweh and his word to keep his feast. They'll say, oh, that's Old Testament, in rapid return fire, and say that's nothing for us to do in this day and age. We're all under grace. And then in the next breath, they'll quote Psalms, or they'll quote David. They'll talk about the book of Genesis and creation. Well, they'll support a New Testament teaching with an Old Testament truth. Wait a minute. Something's not adding up here. Is the New Testament for us today or not? If it's not, don't quote it. Get out of the Old Testament, I should say, not the New, the Old Testament. Get out of it, because you don't need it. You just told me it's not for us today. There's always that. It seems like there's always, no matter what topic you want to discuss, there's always that conflict. There's always that contradiction that you hear. Wait a minute, you know, it doesn't square. It doesn't square with the scriptures. All scripture is given by inspiration, Peter said, and is necessary for doctrine and teaching. All scripture. That includes Old Testament, which is the foundation of everything. So, there it is. There's the command to keep it. As go Yahweh's first fruits people, so goes the world. You see how important these days are? In Yahshua's Olivet prophecy, Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, Yahshua issued statements dealing with end time events, and the camera focuses on those and then pans over to his people sitting there as the first fruits. How do they fit into this sequence? How do they fit into this panorama? How do they fit? And how does that affect prophecy? You see it all the way through the word. First fruits. Because you and I are keeping his feast today, his Sabbath yesterday, we fit the description of his people. The Sabbath is the one sign of his true people. The Sabbath is a sign. The name is the seal. We're sealed by his name. The sign. Without his people in the world, this world would have self-destructed probably many, many years ago. Those who are obedient to his name, his laws, his feast days, these are those that are being called today. And it's very humbling. Think about it. Except for the elect's sake, the days will be shortened. Think about that. Paul in Colossians 4 and 2 Timothy 4 praise some of those who had worked with him. He says, Epaphras, who is one of you, a servant of Messiah, salutes you, always laboring fervently for you in prayers, that you may stand perfect and complete, he says, in all the will of Elohim. All the will of Elohim. To observe all that he's commanded for us to do and to keep. And he puts the blessings on us when we do. He makes his people special to him. Sure, it's easy to make excuses for not keeping his days. You know, we can all do that. I've got my job to think about, you know. I don't have any vacation left this year, and I just can't make it. And my finances are low, and my family's giving me trouble, etc., etc., etc. We've heard them all. To which Yahweh responds, who has the power to grant salvation unto you ultimately? Your boss, your banker, your family? Who's going to do that? You know, when the final summation is meted out, when the checks and balances of the all things are brought into proper focus, who's going to give the ultimate reward? Draw nigh to Yahweh, he will draw nigh to you, it says. Pull away and he'll do the same. Aside from drawing us to Yahweh, the feasts are an annual test, really, of our obedience. How willing is this brother or this sister to do what Yahweh commanded him to do? How willing? Does he or she really love me, Yahweh asks? Will they do what I've asked of them? Do I really come first in their lives, or is it all talk? I'm just making a great case, which is nothing but fluff. It's significant that as Yahweh brought Israel to Sinai to make a close and personal covenant with him, they turned to Moses and said, "Moses, you talk to him. We can't handle this face-to-face confrontation. We can't handle this direct involvement with our Creator." And the feast, really, brethren, our direct involvement. You know, it's not easy to come out of the world. Well, today isn't so tough, but you come out, on a weekday or some other time, spend a week, that's tough because you're odds with the world. The world doesn't want you going there. The world wants to continue on just as it was. Your family wants you to continue on just as you were. Your job, they want you to continue. They don't want you going anywhere. That's when we prove to Yahweh we're willing to make these, and these aren't big things. It just takes a little effort. They're not really that big. But they're going to prove us, and when the real test comes, then we'll be ready. In prayer, we ask Yahweh to do things for us all the time. Help me do this. Help me overcome this. Help me, help me, help me. Protect me. Get me out of this predicament. But when it comes to his expectations, we say, well, I got some other things I got to do. I don't have the time. I just can't do it. Maybe next time. When it comes to his feasts, he says, keep them. Show. Prove me now herewith. Prove to me that you are my first fruit. It's always amazing to me that people will pray to the good Lord and when they're in trouble, but they'll do absolutely nothing when it comes to what he expects of them. They'll scurry around, find excuses, those days are gone away. Those are Old Testament laws. You don't need that. They were all nailed to the stake. Where's the love of Yahweh in that? We're serving Yahweh. And he commanded these days way back at the beginning. We're serving Yahweh. The love of Yahweh is what? 1 John 2, 3-5. Keeping his commandments. He that says, I know him, keeps not his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoso keeps his word, in him verily is the love of Elohim perfected. Perfected. Interesting word. Hereby know we that we are in him, if we keep his commandments. What it all boils down to is that those who refuse to keep his days, his Sabbaths, his commands, and call upon his name, they're really revealing their own low view of the one they worship. Their own less than perfect commitment to the one they claim is the one they hope for when it comes to their ultimate salvation. If they had high reverence for Yahweh, they would do everything he asks every time. No questions. If they stood in awe of him, they would bow down to him all the time. Anything he says. They try to please him, whatever he asks. Not make excuses or argue their way out of it. Or use some kind of justification. Anything possible to try to make themselves feel good, maybe. Try to exempt themselves. It all boils down to a simple lack of reverence for the one whom they direct their worship to. You simply can't worship him in truth if you don't respect him enough to keep his instructions. Simply doesn't work. And that's what it all boils down to. Peter's sermon was so powerful and inspired by the Spirit that Feast of Weeks 2,000 years ago, he spoke on the strength of prophetic truth. He spoke on what was going to come to pass. And he moved no fewer than 3,000 to commit to Yahweh. Where is that same commitment today? Acts chapter 2, verse 37. The feast, the message of this feast is all about the first fruits harvest, and it's about ready. I think we've come to the end of this time, just as we do in Yahweh's feast, when we come to the end of the feast of first fruits, the time when his people are ready to surrender to him, because there is no more time left. It's getting close. Acts 2:37. And it's time that everyone woke up. Now when they had heard this, they were pricked in their heart and said unto Peter and to the rest of the apostles, Men and brethren, what shall we do? Then Peter said unto them, Repent and be baptized, every one of you, in the name of Yahshua the Messiah for the remission of sins, and you shall receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. The same gift that they saw resting on all those people there in that room. For the promise is unto you and to your children and to all that are afar off, even as many as Yahweh or Elohim shall call. And with many other words did he testify and exhort, saying, save yourselves from this untoward generation. It's kind of the same thing we say today, isn't it? This untoward generation, this Babylon we're living in, that's perverting and turning away from Yahweh. And it's these times we need to be stronger and come together as a body. It's much more important now. This crooked is how the companion Bible translates that word. The message of the Feast of First Fruits is that the first fruit harvest is about ready. We as the body of first fruits are being called now. Relatively few at this time, you know, compared to the world, 6 billion. But it's the cream of the crop that Yahweh has chosen first. It's the first fruits that get the double portion of the blessings, just like the firstborn of Israel. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, I plan to read that. I guess we're running out of time, but Paul talks about the natural versus the spiritual. And through the spirit power of Yahweh, we're drawn to him and instructed by him. And it can only be by the Spirit. We can't discern these things of ourselves. It has to be by Yahweh's Spirit that the natural man finds Yahweh's truths. I find it incredible that he would select me out of billions of people on this earth. I deserve nothing of it. But I want to make good on that calling and make that calling and election sure. And my prayer is that you do too. May Yahweh bless you.